The following audio is from Fathom Church in downtown Littleton, Colorado. More information about Fathom can be found at fathomchurch.org.
All right. Good morning, church. Hey, grab a Bible, please. There are Bibles under every single chair. You can open a phone or a tablet. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 30 today. We love everybody to have a hand on the text. If I haven't met you, my name's Chris. I'm the lead pastor here. Good to be back. Hey, wasn't it awesome having Luke preach last week? If you weren't here and you missed it, you need to video that with him on the website, because brother preached his first sermon ever, and I'm telling you, like, my time here is limited. Like, you're going to want to pay him sooner rather than later to do that. Genesis 30 is where we're at this week. As you're turning there, we're going to cover a topic in this sermon today that's very important, okay? The topic that we're going to see in our text today is the topic of work, okay? For most of us, the majority of our adult lives will be spent at work. Your waking hours, okay? Let's throw out sleeping, okay? But like, and I think as a whole, the church as a whole has done a very poor job of helping Christians think biblically about their careers, their vocations, their work. And so if you're going to spend the majority of your time at this place, we probably should figure out what God has to say about work, about what we do with our time. Because many of us who follow Jesus falsely think that following Jesus means be involved in your church and get involved in a small group and tithe your money. And that's kind of your spiritual side of things. And all of those things are really important. Hear me, we want your money, okay? I want you in a small group, okay? I want you to come here and fill these chairs. Like, that's good for my work, right? Like, that's important. But I really want you to discover how to follow Jesus for those 40 to 60 plus hours a week that you're spending doing something that you went to school for, that you have gained skills for, that you essentially are employed under. Okay, I want you to understand how to follow Jesus in your work. Because, you see, serving God actually in the workplace is not an afterthought in the Bible. It's littered all throughout the Bible. So in the book of Acts is the New Testament book where it chronicles kind of the early church after Jesus ascends to heaven and his earliest followers begin to expand this church thing. In the book of Acts, 39 out of the 40 miracles, and I went through and read it and counted this week, okay? 39 out of the 40 miracles in the book of Acts take place in the workplace. It takes place in the workplace. Of the 52 parables that Jesus told, 52 of them, 45 of those actually have a workplace context. And then Jesus had 12 disciples, right? We talk about these guys all the time. The 12 disciples, not one of them came from the religious establishment of their day. They were all essentially called into this following of Jesus from businesses of one form or another. So what that means is this: the primary place that God wants to work is not in here, like while I'm preaching, but rather out there through you, in your work. So serving God in work is not foreign in the Bible, okay? But it seems to be for us. It seems to be for many in this evangelical Christian world that we live. So like I said, I think most Christians seem to think of their faith as something that they do in church, kind of segregated from the rest of their lives. But in that line of thinking that our jobs, and when I mean our jobs, I mean your jobs, because my job is this, right? Like, I'm a professional Christian. I get paid to be good. Y'all have to just be good for nothing, right? Like, that's but that kind of thinking, the kind of thinking that Christians have in this world is that our jobs tend to be secular and they're necessities that must be endured to put bread on the table. And if God has any interest in our jobs, it's just that we don't cheat and that, you know, we tithe off of our income. But when we think, I was trying to think of like how maybe we misthink about Christians in work. And I thought, you know, we tend to think about people who try to bring God into their workplace and all kinds of crazy, disturbing images come to mind. So maybe you think of to be a Christian businessman, that means you need to open a Christian business, right? Like Christian business. I don't know how a business can be born again, but at some level, like, okay, you start a coffee shop and you call it He Brews, right? Or... or holy grounds, and you're like, you know, I just puke in my mouth a little bit thinking about that. Maybe for you in work, like this is how you kind of Christianize it, as you say Merry Christmas, kind of defiantly rather than Happy Holidays, or you just kind of sneak in there like, hey, have a blessed day. Real, I mean, that's kind of your subversive Christian move in your workplace. Or maybe it's forcing like awkward Christian moments into sales calls, right? So you're like, hey, now that I've sold you life insurance, can I talk to you about insurance after you die? No, you don't do that? Okay, good. Or maybe this, like, I've gotten your name on our mailing list, but more important, would you like to be on the roster of heaven, the list of heaven? No? I would not encourage you to do those things unless you want to get fired and hated. But is that what being a godly Christian in work really means? Just trying to kind of force Jesus into something in your work. Like we've quoted it before, and I'm going to put it up on the screen again, but Abraham Kuyper says this: there's not one square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. And hear me, that certainly must include your places of work. So today I want to look into this next movement of Genesis, into Genesis chapter 30, and I think we're going to see some traits, four traits specifically about godly work. And so we've been following Jacob in Genesis for the last few weeks, and Jacob has been an interesting character to look at. God's going to use this man's family in his master plan to kind of undo everything that is broken in our world. And brother from day one has been kind of questionable, right? Not exactly your top grade guy to use, but God has chosen him, and he's going to essentially give him this covenant promise that we have seen and promise him three things. First, Jacob would be made into a great people. The second, God would give Jacob great prosperity. And then third, that Jacob's family would inhabit a place, the Holy Land. So that's three P's: people, prosperity, place. We're going Southern Baptist on you, right? Like, and so last week, Luke preached about the people, right? The 11 sons and one daughter were born to Jacob's two wives and two handmaidens. It was a little sketchy, kind of. He called it the Genesis Duggar family. It was a weird thing. I thought that was pretty right on. But that was the people. We're starting to see Jacob become this people. Next week and following, we're going to kind of see Jacob move back into this place. But today we're going to deal with his prosperity, his work, his God's provision for him. So Jacob is working for his sketchy uncle slash father-in-law. Do the math. That's really weird, right? He's working for his uncle slash father-in-law, Laban. That's where we're at, Genesis chapter 30. So here we go. We're going to start in verse 25. We're going to finish off this chapter. Genesis 30, 25. As soon as Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, that's his uncle, send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, that I may go, for you know the service that I have given you. So Jacob minces no words right off the bat here when it comes to his request, okay? He wants to leave. He's tired of working for Laban. And so traditionally, his father-in-law would have given him gifts, especially to his daughter's gifts, as they would kind of move into their new life together. But here we see that Jacob and Laban have no relationship. Apparently, when you deceive your future son-in-law into marrying your ugly daughter first, it just doesn't go over well long-term for your relationship. But that's kind of where we're at. Jacob does not expect to receive anything. He just wants out. But what we also note in these first couple verses of our text is that Jacob has now been working for Laban for 14 years. But those 14 years, what he earned, his pay, was the two wives. So he's broke. Bro's been working for 14 years and hasn't pulled a paycheck, just has two wives, two handmaidens, and a bunch of kids. And he's like, I've got to go. I got to get out of here. Look at verse 27. But Laban, his uncle, then says to him, if I have found favor in your sight, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages and I will give it. So Laban is a businessman here. Okay, he knows that Jacob is the very reason why he has been blessed. Because verse 27 says that he learned this by divination. Now, that Hebrew word for divination, there's some debate over that. He could have learned it through some sort of like dark pagan means, but that can also really be translated as that Laban simply observed what was going on and concluded that it was Jacob who was the source of this blessing. But either way, the point I want to note here is that he blesses the Lord. Like he mentions the God of Jacob and as the source, essentially, by which he is being blessed. And this is the first trait that I want to point out about godly work. And I'll put these up there so you guys can see them. But the first trait is this: godly work is a witness. Godly work is a witness, because Laban is not a man of faith. He's not. As we're going to see, man, he is. His overriding interests here are not people or even his family or the Lord, but rather money. But in the midst of that, Laban readily affirms that his prosperity is a direct result of Jacob's God. Church, do you realize that how you work is actually a reflection of God? Everything that you do in your occupation is actually a reflection of who God is. And it's part of how God is revealing himself to this world, to an unbelieving pagan world. Like, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but work is not a bad thing. Your work might be, but it's not on a whole like a bad thing, okay? It's not a necessary evil. It's not something that you have to do to earn a paycheck, and then one of these days you're going to retire, and then you'll get to actually do what you were meant to do. No, that's not how work is meant to be. In the Bible, work is actually something that came about before the fall, before Genesis 3. So God, this is the story. We read about this a couple years ago. God places Adam in the Garden of Eden, and then his assignment is this: you're to work the ground and to keep it. He's assigned to do work before the fall, before sin enters the equation. So work was not the punishment inflicted to Adam for his sin. It was a part of God's original design. This is why work is a good thing. And the Hebrew word for work literally means to prepare or to develop. Like work the ground, it means to develop or prepare or cultivate that ground. So essentially, God made Adam a gardener. He made him a gardener before sin ever entered the equation. And listen, a gardener is not the same as a park ranger. They're not. A gardener cultivates stuff that's already there. A park ranger just kind of sits around and guards what's already happening. Adam's job was not to just watch the garden. It was to partake in cultivating the garden, to develop it. So work is essentially taking raw materials that God has given us and developing them for the glory of God and for the benefit of humanity. So it is each one of our calls in every work that we do to better society for the glory of God. So contractors, okay, if you're in construction or something like that, you take the raw materials of wood and cement and other things, and you use them to create buildings and structures and roads and things that are for the betterment of society. And artists, they take the raw materials of color and music, and they rearrange them into things that are beautiful to our eyes and to our ears for us to enjoy. And lawyers, even lawyers, yes, lawyers, that Justin just made fun of. We have a lawyer in here, so be careful, okay? Like, lawyers, okay, they take the principles of justice and codify them into laws that benefit society. All work is meant to do this, to glorify God and to better society. So the reformer, the great reformer Martin Luther, he had this robust theology of vocation. I mean, it was awesome. If you want to geek out over it, you read some Luther. But this is a great quote by Luther. He says this: when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we ask God to give us this day our daily bread. And he does give us our daily bread. He does it by means of a farmer who planted and harvested the grain, the baker who made the flour into bread, and the person who prepared our meal. So you see, some of you, like, in your work, you feel almost this divine satisfaction. right? Like maybe you're not even a Christian, okay? But like, but a sense of a deep satisfaction, like you know you're doing what you were born to do. I think many business people feel that way. They're doing something that they love, and it's like, this is what I was made for. This is what I was created for. It's like you almost feel the Spirit of God in you, like working through you in your work. And hear me, that's because you were made for this. You were made to work, and how you work is actually a witness to the world around you. Now, some of you, this is resonating with big time. Some of you hate your jobs. So let's do just a note of clarification here, okay? Because one of the curses from the fall in Genesis 3 was that now our work has become toilsome. It's become toil. God cursed the ground and said that the thorns and thistles would frustrate our work efforts. So work at that point became a compulsory act of survival. It was not delightful the same way it was before sin. So for all of us, hear me in this part, our work is only going to be partially fulfilling. It's also going to be toilsome and draining. And frankly, sometimes the bane of your existence, right? And listen, for some of you, if you hate your job entirely and you're only doing it to survive, like if it were possible, like tomorrow, you would quit, right? Like you would go in there, you'd take that TPS report, you'd staple it to your boss's forehead and you say, I'm out, right? Like that would be your dream. You'd be dreaming about that. Let me just say those effects are a sad result of the curse. And you may have to work for a while in that kind of condition, or hear me, maybe for the rest of your life. You might have to toil at work. Tim Keller will say of this generation, I'll put it up on the slide, he's great. Our generation insists that work be fulfilling and fruitful, that it fully fit our talents and our dreams, and that we be paid exorbitantly for it. Which sounds great to me. But this is not the world that we live in, okay? We live in a different world, a post-fall world. This is what would have happened in the pre-fall, Adam and Eve in the garden, everything was very good world. So what do you do if you're in a job that you hate? I just think you faithfully work and produce in that job, knowing that it is helping someone, and there can be a certain pleasure in that. You can still be a witness in that. And listen, if you have to wait until heaven to be fulfilled in your work, then that's our patient call as Christians. Like, consider for just a moment that there might be a distinction between your job and the pursuit of calling that God has placed in your life. Right? So, for example, the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, his calling was to be an apostle to the Gentiles, right? A church planter. He preached the gospel. But what did he do for his 9 to 5? Brother, he built tents. He was a tent maker. And that funded God's calling in his life. Some people do other things to free them up to do the main thing. And if you are one of those rare people, hear me, rare people who finds fulfillment fully in their work that God has called you in, hear me, that's awesome, but it's not a right. It's not a right. So whatever you're going to do, okay? Whatever you're going to do, you're called to work. Whether it's pastoring or painting or paralegal or parenting, your godly work is a witness to people. Okay, that's the first thing. So Laban now, in his slyness, knows that he is really going to be owe Jacob nothing, right? He's worked 14 years. He can kind of ask for whatever he wants. He's given him his wages, the two daughters. So if Jacob wants a penny, then he will have to renegotiate. So he says, hey, name your price. Name your price. Essentially, hey, we're going to renegotiate. I want some more years of work. Let's figure this thing out. You've blessed me. Let's figure this thing out. Verse 29. So Jacob said to him, you yourself know how I have served you and how your livestock has fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also? So Jacob actually agrees with Laban here. It's like the first time ever that these two guys see eye to eye, right? But he says, it was the Lord that blessed him through Jacob. But in this, this was a real clever thing, right? Jacob says here, he reminds his sketchy uncle at this point that he was broke before he showed up, right? Laban wasn't doing so hot until Jacob shows up. He says, before I came, you had little, and now it has increased abundantly. See, in this, these two verses, I think I see a second trait of godly work, and it's this. Man, godly work is excellent. Godly work is excellent. Here's what I mean by that. Jacob's been working for his uncle, who's kind of a jerk, for 14 years and didn't get anything out of it except for two wives who are kind of the bane of his existence at some level. Like, it's harsh. We saw that last week. It was rough for brother, right? 14 years, hasn't gotten paid, and here's what we know. He didn't slough off. He didn't do just enough to get by. Like, even in those latter 7 years, like, remember the first 7 years, he gets the first wife, the one he doesn't like, and then a week later, he gets the wife he likes, but he has to work seven more years. Even in those 7 years, he's in. He's working hard. He's putting excellence into his work so that his uncle will reap the benefit. Jacob's work was excellent, even when his employment situation was far from ideal. Okay? Oh, that we would learn from this, church. Oh, that we would learn from this model. Even when you aren't prospering, God is working through your work. And he expects you to work towards excellence. So Paul will say this in Colossians chapter 3. I'll put it on the screen. Whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. See, what Paul is saying in the New Testament, what we're seeing in Jacob in the Old Testament, is that you actually have a much higher boss than your current employer. Right? You work for a greater calling than actually what you see in your job description and what you receive as your benefits package. In everything that you do, Paul says, you do it unto God, which means that you do it as a statement of God's worthiness. So somebody says, okay, well, my boss is a total dumpster. I hate him or her. He doesn't ever give me recognition. He's always coming down on me. He's always changing his expectation. He is a terrible leader. What should I do? Like, listen, I know it's hard. I've worked for guys that are hard. It causes a loss of motivation. It makes Mondays feel like Monday, right? But you're not really doing it for your boss. You're not really working for your boss, even if you are your boss. Let that one mess your mind up, right? You're not working for you. You're doing it for God. Paul says that this is one of the things that should set Christians apart, that they do their work to the glory of God. Whether you eat or drink or mop floors or write contracts, you do everything for the glory of God. In everything that we do in our work, we should say, the way I do this is a statement of God's worthiness. I do it for you, God. So godly work is excellent, even when the circumstances aren't. Well, let's see what happens here in verse 31. Laban said, well, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this for me, I will again pasture your flock and keep it. Verse 32, let me pass through all your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and they shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later. When you come to look at my wages with you, everyone that is not speckled or spotted among the goats and black among the lambs is found, if found with me, shall be counted as stolen. Okay, let me explain this, okay? Normally a shepherd in this time would negotiate a contract with their employer for about 10 to 20% of the animals and then the products that the animals produce, like wool or dairy, things like that, okay? Jacob's offer here is way below the going rate. It's just way below the going rate for a shepherd. So Laban likely at this moment thinks that Jacob is just being plain stupid. Like doesn't, like young guy in a new business doesn't know what he's asking for. And so literally you see, most sheep are either all white or all black or all brown. And striped and spotted sheep are extremely rare. Now hear me, if you're a shepherd, I have no idea if that's true or not. I just read it this week. So I'm just trusting some other guys who know something about sheep. I have no idea. I knew a goat named Biscuit once. That's the extent of my shepherding, okay? That's a true story. I don't know what it means, but here's what we're Jacob is offering to take the most rare form of the flock, the rarest of the rare, and then only keep those as his payment. So on every level for Laban, this is a deal. Like there's no loopholes. This is going to be great. He couldn't lose. So look what he says in verse 34. Laban said, "Good, of course, right? Good, let it be as you have said." But that day Laban removed the male goats that were striped and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and he put them in charge of his sons. And he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob pastured the rest of Laban's flock. Okay, Laban eagerly is like, "You're a sucker, bro. I'll take that deal, right? I'm in. You can have every speckled and spotted and, you know, however you want to put it, weird sheep. You're a sucker." And I just imagine him like walking away laughing to himself. I can just imagine him doing this. But here's the point I want to note. Jacob, in the last section, he said, "My honesty will answer for me." Like Jacob wants to preserve his integrity here. He was the deceiver. That's what his name means. And then he was deceived, right? He was deceived into marrying the daughter he didn't want to. But now he seemingly wants to do something ethical. So he says, "Listen, my honesty will be in the work. You'll be able to look at the flock and see if I'm being honest or not." But then Laban, on the other hand, does something completely opposite of that, right? Like immediately after he makes this deal, this skewed deal that he's already going to win, he's going to hedge his bets. So essentially he sees his flock and he pulls out all of the spotted and speckled and discolored lambs and he pulls them into their own flock and he sends them 3 days away to be shepherded by his sons. And he leaves all the purebreds with Jacob. This is sketchy on two levels. First is this, that was his first installment of pay. Right? If he only gets the little weird lambs, he just pulled all the weird ones out and sent them off. He's got nothing. That's dishonest. Second part of this being sketchy is this: he likely thinks that only pure lambs will breed pure lambs, and only speckled and spotted lambs will breed more speckled and spotted lambs. So again, he's hedging his bets. He's trying to keep it all for himself, leaving Jacob with nothing. Again, what a great grandfather to his grandkids, right? Like, I mean, you just got to keep remembering. He's got 12 grandkids that have to be fed by this guy, but whatever. So he separates them. And listen, this is, I think in this, we see the third trait of godly work. You probably know what I'm going to say here, but Jacob is showing us that godly work is ethical. Godly work is ethical. Whereas Laban is the model for lack of integrity and care, godly work is ethical. Did I spell it wrong? Sorry. There's an extra I there. Spell check doesn't work on all caps, apparently. So let me illustrate with this. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who's best known for his detective fiction, Sherlock Holmes, he's a British author. He also worked in the British government, and he once played a practical joke on 12 respected and well-known men in Great Britain. Okay, this is what he did. He sent out to each one of them an anonymous telegram, and he sent it from inside of the government. Okay, he sent it to 12 respected officials, and in that telegram it said, "Flee at once, all is discovered." Thinking this was a joke, okay? And then he checked back in 6 hours, and all 12 of them were making plans to leave. Like, lack of integrity is nothing new in the workplace, right? If our work, though, is to be a witness to God, like we talked about, and ultimately it's to be excellent as if we were working unto the Lord, then it makes complete sense that our work should be ethical. Man, the slide guy is quick. Robbie, good job, bro. God says it like this in the Proverbs 11:1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. So a false balance, as they're weighing out food or money or whatever, a false balance is a bad weight. It's like saying, hey, this thing weighs a pound when it weighs 3/4 of a pound. If you're a child of the 80s like me, man, you think Karate Kid Part 2, right? Nope, okay. Man, you guys got to catch up on your B-roll 80s films. God's saying here, a false balance is an abomination. It's an abomination. For us today, a false balance would be this: fudging mileage reports, padding business expenses, skimping on your time card, calling in sick when you're not actually sick, taking business and office supplies for personal use, unreported income, okay, and so on. Anything really could be an unbalanced weight. And those things, God says, are an abomination. Now, God doesn't fling the word abomination around a whole lot in the Old Testament. And listen, you don't want to know where else he does, because it's demonic. And yet he says, a false balance is an abomination to me. Shady ethics in work are abominable to God. They're abominations to him. I can't tell you how many people I've heard say these sorts of things to me, that they don't like to do business with Christians. You ever heard this? You ever heard this from people? Like I hear of people who get burned doing business with professing Christian companies, right? Because that they're a Christian company because their business card has a little fish on it. Like, somehow that makes them a Christian business. But the problem is that while that little Jesus fish kind of maybe gets them some more business, it's sometimes just an excuse for shoddy work, delinquent pay, lowered expectations. And I'm not trying to criticize Christian business workers. I'm criticizing crappy Christian business workers, okay? You following me here? I've seen it from Christians that think that they deserve a discount from another Christian. They just show up and think, hey, you know what? I deserve a Christian because we follow the same Jesus. Why? Like, I don't know why that is, right? There's like I'm a Christian, I shouldn't have to pay another Christian full price discount or something like that. I've seen it from Christian business owners that leverage their faith as something of a marketing tool to increase their flow, their traffic flow. I was literally just a couple weeks ago talking with a guy from our church who waits tables at a restaurant. He told me that the waiters and waitresses that he works with cringe when they see a table praying before their meal, because they know that the tip is going to be below average on a whole when Christians dine out. Y'all, that's how the world sees us. Next time you bow your head at Chili's, remember that, okay? And listen, if you don't start with 20%, I'll give you another church. We'll go to another church. If you ever think about dropping one of those little Fathom cards in there without like 25%, just I'll hunt you down, okay? It's over. Listen, be ethical, be generous, be a witness, and all of these things are connected in how you work. Godly work is ethical. Well, let's see how this whole thing pans out with these sheep and these speckled, spotted things. Verse 37. Then Jacob took fresh sticks of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white streaks in them, exposing the white of the sticks. And then he set the sticks that he had peeled in front of the flocks in the troughs, that is, the watering places where the flocks came to drink. And since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the sticks. And so the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob separated the lambs and set the faces of the flocks towards the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. He put his own droves apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. Wherever or whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob would lay sticks in the troughs before the eyes of the flock that they might breed among the sticks. But for the feebler of the flock, he would not lay them there. So the feebler would be Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. Thus, the man increased greatly and had large flocks, female servants and male servants, and camels and donkeys. So I love that they just tag on there, camels and donkeys, which is essentially like he had a Mercedes and a Beamer. That's kind of what that meant in the first century, Old Testament. What's the deal with the branches? Right? Like, I don't know. At some level, it's just like, maybe. Some commentators, okay, here we go. I really have no idea. Some commentators want to try and make the point that Jacob is, in fact, very conscientious in what he's doing with these branches, okay? That he, in this movement, he knew how to spot recessive traits in these sheep and was able to, in like a very primitive way, practice some sort of selective breeding here. Nah, I don't think so. Maybe, okay, I have a hard time believing that theory, mostly because if we're next week in chapter 31, God actually tells us that he revealed in a dream to Jacob the whole sticks and spotted speckled thing. So this brilliant strategy is actually from God, but I don't think, so hear me, I don't think Jacob is operating out of some sort of enlightened scientific principle here. But here's what I think. At worst, he's superstitious. He thinks that you make striped sticks, put them in front of sheep, and they're going to make striped sheep. Essentially, that's what Laban did. He pulled all the striped ones and said, get them out of there. The purebreds are going to breed more purebreds. So at worst, I think it's superstition. At best, it might be true obedience to God, if God revealed it to him in a dream, which we'll find out he did last week. So hear me. The Bible is not teaching us that animals are susceptible to prenatal stimuli, okay? So just, this isn't a science textbook. Just be careful here, okay? If you've got a couple sheep, don't throw some sticks out there hoping you can, like, make some cool-looking sheep with sticks that have, like, engravings on them. I don't know. It's just not possible, okay? Rather, Jacob's rods are not what produce the speckled and the spotted sheep, but rather what we're to get out of this is that God is in control here. That God is the one who's going to make this prosperity come along. It's similar, actually, to last week's story that Luke shared with us, the little story about the mandrake fruit, if you were with us, you remember this? It's not that the mandrakes opened up Leah and Rachel's wombs. God did. Through the means of this symbol. So however it happened in this story, whether Jacob is superstitious or obedient, however informed he is on what's happening, this is the last trait of work that I see here, of godly work. Godly work is prosperous. Godly work is prosperous. God was the one who did this. He was the one who prospered Jacob. Now hear me, I throw that word out there very cautiously because we have to do a little bit of work around the word prosperity, right? Prosperous is a dangerous word because how many of you have heard of prosperity theology? Plenty of you, okay. It's very popular and we just dog on it all the time here. It's particularly popular on late night TV, right? With a guy who, you know, is larger and sweating a lot and he's yelling at you to sow an uncommon seed and reap an uncommon harvest and his wife's on over to the side in like a pantsuit and she looks like she lost a paintball war and it's just kind of, you know, they're up there and they're kind of, they got the choir in the background kind of singing and essentially they're just robbing people of their coin. See, it's fun. But listen to me, this is one of their favorite texts. This is one of their favorite texts because they'll look at it and they'll say, just look, God prospered Jacob, right? You got to name it and claim it, right? You got to blab it and grab it, right? Just to kind of shake and bake, do the whole thing, okay? You can be rich. God wants to prosper you. He did it to Jacob. He can do it to you. Write me a check. That's their message. And he pulls out a hanky, mops his brow, and asks for donations. Like, that's the process. That's not what I'm talking about here, okay? Don't think about that when I'm saying that God's work is prosperous. Prosperity here is this. Jacob, from all I can see, has worked with integrity and honesty. He's been obedient to God, and he's gotten ripped off by his uncle left and right. But now God's prospering him. Church, God will prosper you. Not in the way that those prosperity theologians, if you could even call them that, like teach. Right? God will prosper you. If you pursue godly traits in your work, God will bless you. And sometimes, hear me, it will come in material blessings. Some of you are going to earn a lot of cash. You're going to have a lot of nice things. And that's not a sin. But hear me, it's not necessarily material prosperity that you will gain. That's not what's promised here. Sometimes it will be material, and other times it's going to come in other ways. But the main thing is this, we're to work like Jacob, as a witness, as unto the Lord, with complete integrity, and knowing that those things, through those things, God will provide and prosper our lives. The goal is not to be like Laban, who just wants to get rich, at the expense of his children and grandchildren. The goal is to be like Jacob. We don't use God to get rich. We honor God with our work, and then God will give to us what God decides is prosperous for us. So godly work is a witness, okay? It's excellent. Godly work is ethical, and it's prosperous. Those are those four things. Now, I've got a word of warning, and this is going to be the last little thing. Worship God, not your work. Like, work is a good thing. I think we've seen that in the text. But here's the tendency for us to worship our work rather than worship our God. Worship God. You see, when Adam and Eve fell out of fell into sin, our relationship to work changed. And what God had given us to be something that we enjoyed, to be something that would glorify him, and to be something that we would use to serve others, to better the society. Instead, work for us became one of the primary sources of identity and idolatry. And I see this all the time. I find it in myself all the time. Because of the fall, many of us worship our work. In that we make it our identity, right? So it's like the second question we ask. What's your name? What do you do? Every time you meet somebody, that's a sin. I did it in the hallway today. What do you do? And many people are defined by the fact, listen, that they don't have to work anymore. Like, you hear this as like a badge of honor. I'm independently wealthy. I don't work anymore. I'm awesome, right? Like that's kind of it's like a badge of honor. Oh, I'm retired. I live the Jimmy Buffett lifestyle on the beach, playing golf, right? Like, that's kind of the badge of honor. Some people make work their primary security, which is why you're so paranoid of losing your job, right? I think this is why so many of us are discouraged by the fact that we haven't gotten further ahead in work, because essentially, hear me, you've replaced God with work as your primary source of identity. But church, don't worship your work. Work is a terrible God. God is a great God. Work is an awful, terrible God. It'll let you down. God is much better at being God than your work is at being your God. The identity that he can give you as a son or as a daughter is so much more is just so much better than the identity that your work can give you. He's the one that you can depend on. You don't need to depend on your paycheck. God will provide for you. He's much better source of security, because he's the one who is taking care of your ultimate problem, right? Not a lack of money or status or education or talent. Your primary problem is that you're cursed. All of us are cursed, and we're dead in our sin. And then God loved you so much that he came and he took that punishment for you, right? Dying to reconcile you to God. That's the gospel. That's more important. And if he took care of you in that, don't you think he'll care for your day-to-day? God is a much better God than work. So you should give your heart and soul to God and then go do your work. Instead of going to give your heart and your soul to your work and then occasionally serving God. Flip those things. You could say it like this. When Jesus is your life, you can enjoy the rest of your life. You hear me? Okay. Fathom, I don't want you to ignore this part of your life, because time-wise, you're going to spend a majority of your time waking and working. but I want you to be godly in your work. It's a witness to the world. It needs to be excellent in everything that you do, as unto the Lord. Godly work needs to be ethical. You need to be above the line of reproach. You need to be so far away from the line that it looks like a dot, right? Like, you need to be full of integrity. And then God will prosper you in the way that he sees fit. Church, work matters to God, but God matters in your work. Let's pray. Father, I don't know what you were doing when you wrote this speckled and spotted business, but God, I trust that it's there for our edification. I trust that it's there because you have purpose for those words. And as we saw today, God, I pray that we would have a three-dimensional, 360-degree view of our lives. That our spiritual lives are not something that happens in church and in small group, but that our whole lives, our work, our family, our friends, our hobbies, that all of it, you died for all of us, all of it, to redeem all of our lives. And especially in our work, Father, I pray for my brothers and sisters in here who might be struggling in a job that they hate. God, I pray encouragement there. I pray you help them have eyes to see ways that you can be glorified in that they can be godly in that endeavor. And God, for folks in here who have seen their work as their identity, they love it, they feel so good about it, they almost, it's like a relationship to them that keeps them warm and satisfied. Lord, I pray that you break some chains this morning. Lord, help us know that work is a good thing, but it can never become a God thing, because that's a bad thing. So God, we were created to labor, to work. God, I pray that through our work, Lord, you be glorified. Lord, that ultimately your name be made famous in our jobs, in our workplaces, with our customers. And Lord, ultimately that society is cultivated because of it. That we are not just here for us, but we are here for the betterment of this world. God, we're grateful for this text. I'm thankful for these speckled and spotted sheep. So Lord, help us to know how to apply this in our lives. We love you, Father. I'm grateful for this, and we pray all this in the name of Jesus. Amen.